you people feel like making some noise tonight?
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, Cookie Monster's favorite radio station.
Good night, Chicago! Brutal!
Juicebox is a sexuality education show geared to adult audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Dropped into Juicebox Radio, where sexuality educators quench your search for responsible, progressive sexuality over your lifespan. Yes, yes, yes. Don't touch that dial. You're exactly where you want to be. You've landed in Juicebox Radio on CITR 101.9 FM with myself, and my poor little Caroline is homesick tonight, so it's just me and thankfully a guest, because you wouldn't just want to be listening to me all night, that's for sure. If you're one of our online listeners live at CITR.ca, welcome. And if you ever miss a show, you can download a podcast at juiceboxradio.com. Always entertaining and educational. Tonight's Juicebox show is about transgender studies, featuring an in-depth discussion with Dr. Susan Stryker. We're going to be taking calls tonight, so feel free to call in and contribute to the conversation we're having at 604-822-2487. That's 604-UBC-CITR. And I want to welcome our esteemed guest, Dr. Susan Stryker.
Hey, thanks.
Welcome to Juicebox Radio. I really appreciate you coming out because, as you're going to find out, listeners, she's a very busy woman. I mean, not just a professor. Professors are always crazy busy, but she's putting together a big conference that is happening May 1st to 3rd downtown SFU campus. We're going to talk a little bit about that later in the show. But not only that, but Dr. Stryker holds the Ruth Wynn Woodward Chair at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. She's visiting from... I think it's UCLA. No, Berkeley.
San Francisco.
So she's on this lovely. I guess you call it an academic. Is it a visit? What is it?
Visiting professor this
exactly.
Year, yeah.
Some of my most favorite courses I ever took in my undergrad and grad degree were usually with visiting professors, because they're quite excited about what they're doing, and they're kind of in a new city, and they're sort of don't have all their friends and family to distract them, so they're quite focused on their students, and I had a really good time. So I'm sure you're doing the same for your students at SFU.
I hope so.
I'm sure.
I think I've been a little inattentive to them. I've been so busy with the conference, but I think they had a good time this year.
Good, good. Well, I would say your current research interests are, what it says is philosophy of the body, body modification, and body technology interrelationships, film and architectural theory as they relate to transgender history, politics, social formations, and subjectivities. Does that sort of speak to what you're interested
in? Boy, that's a mouthful.
I know. Yeah. That's okay. My listeners are going to have a very highly academic evening talk tonight, I think, because it's just me. So we don't have Caroline keeping it real. It's going to be me all theorizing with you. So first question I have, because I think anyone tuning in might want to know, just in case they are tuning in for the first time, this definition for transgender, I think, remains in flux. And if there is a precise definition, personally, I don't believe it's even desirable to have a precise definition for transgender, or it's necessary. But I think for the sake of clarity, for our discussion tonight, what's your working definition of what transgender is?
To try and say it a little bit more, in a little more complicated way first, it's like that. I think that that there's a usual or more common way that any given society will put together, you know, the sort of the sex of the body with a gender identity with a social role. You know, somebody's born with female genitals, they think of themselves as a girl, they live as a woman, right? And that would be a normal, you know, normative gender. And transgender, I think, is anything that breaks apart those relationships somehow. So any kind of, you know, being gender different somehow. I don't think of transgender as being any one kind or type of person. You know, like, it's not just somebody who, say, was born male, but they identify as a woman and they change sex. It's like, that's, you know, one kind of transgender person. I would just say it's a really broad term for anything that's like gender atypical, different, non-normative.
Okay.
So very broad.
So like you're saying, born female genitalia, lives life as a woman, believes they are in that gender identity and that kind of thing. So anywhere that there might be a difference in there.
Yeah, sissy boys, butch lesbians, you know, it's like anything that's okay. Not, you know, straight boy, straight girl.
Interesting. I've never myself thought of trans as somebody who is just particularly feminized. I mean, I've dated a lot of very feminine men over the years and some quite masculinized women, and I wouldn't consider those people trans, but maybe it sounds like you're talking
like I said, that's the sort of the more complicated version, is to think about anything that breaks apart the expected relationship between body, identity, social role. But not everybody who I might look at and say, seeing something kind of trans going on there, they may not self-identify that way. So, you know, you're absolutely right what you said at first, that, you know, nailing down any one hard and fast definition probably isn't the way to go.
No. And I think the more fluid we allow society to be, the more diverse in whatever expression, whether it's the way that they choose to paint or walk down the street or dress or however, I think the better our world will be. Anyway.
Right on.
I'm a diversity advocate, hugely on every capacity. So, all right. So according to the University of Auckland, you went and did a talk down there. Did you in Australia? Like to call it down there.
Auckland is actually in New Zealand.
Oh, thank you. There Sorry, you I'm so not worldly.
But I did that when I was in Australia for a while. For the last several years, I think it's starting in 2003.
Okay.
I have gone to Australia and spent part of the academic year down there every year, working with a really interesting bunch of scholars at Macquarie University in Sydney. Where I was one of the people who helped set up an interdisciplinary research center called the Somatechnics Research Center.
Cool.
Which looks at...
I'm like, what is Somatechnics? That's a cool
sounding
word.
Fun new word. It's a word that we made up to have kind of like a handy label for talking about body technology relationships and how that relates, you know, soma meaning body,
technics
meaning
technical
techniques. Yeah, you got it. And the reason I was interested in that is, you know, kind of like we were talking about earlier, you know, I have this very broad definition of transgender. you know, I see gender practices as a kind of technology. It's just like a set of techniques that we use for communicating a sense of who we are to other people.
Okay.
And so that, you know, I'm really kind of politically interested in not reducing trans phenomena, if you want to think of it that way, to a certain minority class of people. Because I think if you say, oh, there's some transgender people out there, you know, and that nobody else exhibits any kind of gender variance, it, you know, creates this world where you've got a bunch of normal people and then this tiny minority of people who are gender different.
Right.
And I'm interested in looking at how all of us really exhibit a wide range of gender expressions and behaviors, and and that some forms of gender difference get really marginalized and you get punished for them, or it gets you in trouble with the law, or it makes you really socially vulnerable. And so that politically what I'm interested in doing is really broadening the concept of and the awareness of how we're all very gender diverse. So
And just diverse, period. Expression. So,
Right. And so situating transgender studies, not just, you know, like making it like a sexual identity like gay, lesbian, or bi, but situating it in this other way of thinking about how it's a form of body modification and we're all...
We all modify our bodies.
We all modify our bodies. We all use different techniques for modifying our bodies. I mean, everything from how you cut your nails or your hair to, you know, the kinds of clothes you wear and, you know, all kinds of things.
And jewelry or not, or makeup or not, or, and just how you posture yourself. For me, I think posture is a really big descriptor of a person's inner world, is how they kind of stand and walk. And I'm a dancer, so I really appreciate a good posture, somebody who's confident and, you know,
And those kinds of, you know, body techniques, we're always performing ourselves, through certain kinds of bodily motions, bodily practices to other people. And so for me, one way of kind of depathologizing transgender phenomenon is to look at how transgender practices are part of, you know, a wider kind of human activity, that we all modify our bodies, we all express gender in really diverse ways. And by situating transgender in those frameworks, rather than just making it like a, you know, a tiny minority of, you know, weird people, you know, it's like I just find it, I find it politically useful and intellectually interesting. So to get back to your other question, working with these people in Sydney at Macquarie University, I go down there usually once a year. And while I'm in the area, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere, I go around to other universities and do talks and stuff. So yes, I spoke at the University of Auckland a few years ago.
Well, you know what? I was going to ask you about, because you're a well-known, they speak to, of you as a leading theorist of transgender and well-known historian of sexuality, and that you gave a public lecture that included this rough cut from a feature-length documentary about the beginnings of the transgender rights movement. I wanted to talk about sort of the historical thing, and I think that we will get back to that conversation later on tonight in our talk. Because we're talking about the body modification conversation, I want to kind of stay on that train, and we'll get into the conference, because I think that that's all kind of in there with the Soma Technics. Very interesting. When I was looking into that, I Googled it, and there's probably, I think, 8 sites that mention Soma Technics. So it's mostly in Australia. And so really a new and up-and-coming word that I feel quite excited about, the fact that I'm talking about it on Juicebox. And we'll be linking now. There'll be 9 pages on Soma Technics with my radio show as well when I finish doing the podcast later.
Well, thank you for doing your part.
I'm just super excited about this. So these are theories and practices of transgender embodiment, is what you're calling the trans-soma techniques. Now, again, let's just read this. Now, we're talking about soma techniques in a minute. So you're putting together a multidisciplinary international conference downtown on May 1st to 3rd. I'm hoping to make it there for the 2nd. If anyone wants to come down and check me out, people sometimes like to... Yeah, I saw you. Anyway. That's my ego talking. Anyway, it reads that this conference seeks to include a wide range of innovative scholarship, public policy, grassroots activism, sociopolitical analysis, and artistic production in the field of transgendered studies. Especially, you're especially interested in work that calls attention to the interconnections between embodiment, technology, and bodily practice. So this is an emerging area of transdisciplinary research that you're designating with the new term somatechnics. So again, you've described somatechnics. I think that was you did it really well. So let's talk about body modification. We talk about trans people. I think they're often very motivated to change the way that they present themselves to the world and to themselves. So what are some, like, I was thinking about this earlier, and somebody was trying to explain to somebody about the show tonight, and the exact sort of way I described it was, like, how do you sort of get ready to go out in the morning? If you think about how you prepare yourself, you prepare your body, you prepare it with clothing or whatever, do your hair, your teeth, and all that stuff, or whatever your choice is, what are some, like, you know, I sort of thought, well, what about trans people? You know, how was their journey to... And how much do they pay attention to that kind of thing every day? Probably more so than many. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, just speaking for myself, I think I probably pay a little less attention to it. It's just like I'm a very casual person. So, you know, I get up in the morning, I pull on my jeans, I pull on, my hoodie sweatshirt, and out the door I go. For me, it's like, you know, I am transsexual, male to female, and... I think for me, a big motivation for changing something about my body is that, I was one of these people who it's like born male but never identified as boy. And as soon as I could do something about it, I did. It's like I wanted to change my body because I didn't want to have to work so hard to persuade people to accept me
the way that I
felt about myself. So it's like I wanted my body to do the work, you know,
Of the performance that we all do.
Right. We perform identity, not just by, you know, the clothes that we wear, but by things like, you know, the texture of your skin or whether or not there's, you know, hair on your face or breasts on your chest and, you know, like all kinds of things. For me, it's like I wanted my body to do the work of performing my own subjective sense of who I was for other people and not, you know, have to go through, you know, essentially like, you know, putting on a costume every day to like, you know, persuade people to see me the way that I would want to see myself. But to get back to that technologies question, it's like, you know, certainly like people think of like taking hormones or having, you know, genital surgery or something like that as a kind of like technologized form of the body. But I would say that, you know, slathering on a lot of pancake makeup or wearing a corset or, you know, wearing, you know, breast prosthesis is like, that's all technologies too.
Mm-hmm.
You're going female to male, you know, it's like binding your chest or wearing clothes that don't emphasize your hips, things like that.
Or packing a dildo,
packing a dildo. Strapping. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's all a body technology question.
Interesting. I never thought of it in this way, and I really find your research umbrella to be really a powerful and effective way of helping maybe the mainstream to understand a little bit better about how we all do this body technology. We all do this body modification, you know, tattooing, piercing, whatever it might be, to describe who we are to the world in some fashion. So other examples that, like you mentioned some good examples there for different trans people. How has trans body modification changed in history? You're a historian. So back in the day, I think the technologies were quite different. Mm-hmm. So what do you know much about?
Yeah, I'm leery of saying something like there have always been transgender people in all cultures and all times in history, because I think our sense of who we are is always very culturally and historically, geographically, you know, bounded and contingent.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think it's true that if you look at cultures around the world and throughout time, that you find plenty of examples of people who don't fit into what, you know, we in, you know, the modern Eurocentric, you know, world think of as, you know, quote unquote, normal, normative
male
men and women.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, male and female. And so if you look through time at the techniques that people have used. You know, there's examples of genital surgeries, like, way back into the, I mean, honestly, like, they've found, you know, mummies up in the Alps, you know, frozen from, like, you know, Neolithic times where people have practiced genital modification. But, you know, it's like through cutting or marking the body in some ways, like, you know, in a lot of cultures, there's tattooing, and the tattooing is very gender specific, and you'll find cross-gender tattooing, or you'll find people performing a certain kind of social role or work or kinship function that's usually associated with one body type being performed by someone with another body type, usually not associated with that role.
Yeah, I've seen some of that in the work, in the studies and papers I've written over the years, looking into that history as well. It's interesting. I'm thinking maybe in the late 1800s in Europe, for example, where people were maybe being watched a little bit more closely, and there was a lot more judgment kind of going on, and maybe you can speak a little bit to that history.
I think that in actually Western European cultures are some of the more gender rigid cultures that you can find anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And that's really, I think, kind of anomalous, that it's not the most common way for human cultures to organize themselves, to be very fixed on you know, gender normativity.
And roles and responsibilities,
And, you know, I think that it has something to do with the rise of the modern European nation state, that there's a way that sort of fixing gender categories is part of how the state makes use of bodies, that it's part of, you know, sort of the control and regulation mechanism society imposes on all bodies as a way of making them a socially useful body.
Right.
You know, like making them, you know, soldiers or taxpayers or farmers or breeders or, you know, whatever. Right. That the gender norm is part of the relationship between the body and the state.
Right.
So you could think of gender itself as a somatechnic practice for linking social structure with individual bodies, if you wanted to go that way.
Fascinating.
But now techniques for transgender body modification, looking back historically, I don't know the Canadian history as well, I'm embarrassed to say.
Well, you've only been here for a bit.
That's right. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for cutting me that slack. I appreciate it. But in the U.S., the first legal regulations of cross-dressing that I've come across is in 1848, where city, municipal regulations specifically outlaw cross-gender dressing in public.
Wow. So people were doing it.
People were doing it back in the day, right?
And they were trying to clamp down on that.
And they were trying to clamp down on it back then.
Yeah.
Once you had, you know, it's really like the middle of the 19th century that you first get anesthesia and antiseptic surgical practices.
Okay.
Pretty much as soon as surgery is not a likely death sentence for the people who are undergoing it, you start seeing people coming to doctors and saying, hey, would you, you know, mind removing that part, or do you think you could build this part up? You know, really from the middle of the 19th century forward.
Wow.
It's, you know, I found only really isolated examples of that. Yeah. But by around the turn of the 19th, 20th century, medical science has started to pay a lot more attention to, what we'd now call transgender people.
Yeah.
Before then, they were usually either just, you know, talked about as either, like, you know, criminals or sinners. You know, it's like cross-dressing was something that, bad or morally bad or criminally minded people would do. And by the later 19th century, medical science was starting to say, oh, this is a particular kind or type of person, like a homosexual, you know, they're a cross-dresser, a transvestite, a, whatever. There were new medical categories being invented to describe, you know, what we would now call transgender people.
Yeah.
Right. And that once you have that kind of medicalization of trans people, you start to see doctors kind of being more interested somehow in either, you know, curing or addressing somehow the problem of the, you know, quote unquote problem of the transgender body. And you'll start to see, you know, hysterectomies and mastectomies, you know, like in the 1880s and or like the 1890s and first decade of the 20th century. That's been requested by people who say, you know,
just take it off. I'd rather die than live with this any longer. And,
The first male-to-female genital conversion surgeries are like in the 1920s.
Wow.
The first one so it's been going on.
Hopefully it's getting better. I hear that the genital surgeries are still pretty dodgy.
Depends on who you talk to, you know, and which kinds of procedures you're talking about. Generally, you know, from what I hear, the male-to-female surgeries are generally more
successful,
aesthetically and functionally successful, as they say, than female-to-male. You know, it's like I've had genital surgery, and I'm happy as a clam, as they say.
So things are working?
Things are, you know, as Kate Bornstein says, it's like the plumbing works and so does the electricity, you know?
Awesome. It's like I always say plumbing, electricity, and it just occurred to me what the electricity means, and it's like always somehow went over my head. Right. I got the plumbing part, but yeah, wow, the electricity, awesome. I'm going to use that from now on, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
So,
hey,
well, that's good.
Like I just stole it from Kate Bornstein, so.
I don't know if I'll remember her, but I'm remember you.
So
well, that's good.
Right.
I just
and then
heard that pleasure was an issue.
Not for me.
Not for your electricity is working.
So, yeah.
But I heard that especially phalloplasty.
Female to male, there's a wider range of kinds of genital surgeries that people do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a lot of the trans guys decide not to have phalloplasty just because it's really expensive, and it, you know.
And there's really good dildos out there now.
Right. And that, you know, the surgically constructed phallus usually is not innervated. It doesn't have nerve sensation. Sometimes you have to insert something in it to make it
erect
stiff.
Enough to penetrate.
Right.
Interesting. Well, I just think, I mean, the genital surgery conversation, we could probably go on about that for quite a while, and I think that a lot of Juicebox listeners are interested in hearing about those details. But I think I kind of want to talk about sort of other things, because I know that a lot of trans people live in poverty. They can't afford the surgeries, and or I also want to talk about after the break my understanding from the trans people in my life and the young ones that I know, they're starting to sort of do this movement to not do genital surgery and to sort of do more of accepting your plumbing as it is and not make it be that I am a woman, so I must have a vagina. I am a man, so I must have a penis to be a full woman or to be a full man. So I we'll talk about this after the break, but I see this trend happening in the younger generation of trans people where it's like, no, you know, I can change the rest of me, but the genitals, like, they're too dodgy to mess around with, and perhaps they should be left, and the rest of the world needs to change their idea of how it is that I present myself sexually as a male or female. Anyway, good conversation to have after the break, if you don't mind waiting, Dr. Stryker. And let me see if I can do my duty here as the programmer. Lots of important things to do, and I'm usually relying on Caroline now to take care of it. One of the things I have to tell you is that you are on CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Juicebox. Keep that dial locked. We'll welcome your calls during this time especially, so please call in at 604-822-2487, and we will be back right after this. It's not working. I'm supposed to be all fancy. Go. Is it going to work now? What's going on? Oh, you know what it is? I don't have CD3 on. Whoa. That's what's wrong. We'll be back.
Would you like to help students improve their standings in math and English on provincial exams? Would you like to improve your own skills for teaching and leadership? Do you plan on entering the PDP program or law enforcement, youth work, BSW, or medicine? Volunteer as a tutor in an innovative program at QE Secondary School in Surrey in this midweek after-school program. In its 12th year, it has proven to be a rewarding experience for students and volunteer tutors. Contact Ms. Bond at 604-581-3476, 604-581-3476, or email bond_ats@hotmail.com.
Juice Box is a sexuality education show geared to adult audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
And we're back. And that was the Chemical Brothers, We Are the Night. It's their newest album. I can't speak for it, but it was there and I put it in. So hopefully you enjoyed whatever little chunk you got there of the first song, which is called No Path to Follow. Has nothing to do with what our conversation is. That was a terrible name of the first song, but that's just what happened.
The Chemical Brothers. I mean, there you go.
Yes. Well, the hormones can be very, very powerful, effective things for transitioning, for sure. My trans friends, they're on the hormones and just couldn't believe how fast they work. It's pretty crazy. They're powerful things, those hormones, I know. I'm feeling them, especially in the springtime. Anyway, okay. So we are going to be continuing our conversation, our interview with Professor Dr. Susan Stryker in a minute. But first, Juiceberries. There's so many exciting things happening. I know that Caroline loves this portion of the show. I'm sorry she's not here to do it. Hope she's feeling better, getting her rest tonight, not listening to the show actually, but actually sleeping. And that is the Vancouver International Burlesque Fest. It starts tomorrow night with Between the Worlds Burlesque at the Red Room. I'll be there. I'm really excited about it. And it accumulates in a gala wrap-up party on May 3rd. So that's 10 days, kind of Fringe Fest style in Vancouver, extravaganza of sass, sauce, and silliness, all things burlesque. But so much more this year. Third annual. I'm pretty excited about it. Check it out for more information at fanburlesquefest.com. And a good friend of mine, also been at my Juicebox Salon nights, Daniel Packard. Those of you who have been at the salons, you know him. Very hilarious man. He does this evening called Flirt Fest, where intelligent women go after what they want and where men get women hitting on them. So this Thursday, April 24th, 7 o'clock in Vancouver, you can check it out with danielpackard.com for details. And I'm going to be checking out his first live group sex therapy show. It's a new show that he's been doing for the last year, and it's a rare chance to see Daniel's performance of his international touring live group sex therapy show out in Maple Ridge this Saturday, April 26th, 8 o'clock. And danielpackard.com again. So I'm looking really forward to seeing him do his full meal deal. I think it's 2 hours of Daniel. I'm sure I'll be sweating like he does by the end of the 2 hours. Anyway, and then there's Kundalini Dance. I'm a huge advocate for Kundalini Ecstatic Dance. They do fabulous workshops, 8-part series for cleansing and balancing your chakra system, etc. Find out more about that at kundalinidance.com, and that's K-U-N-D-A-L-I-N-I. kundalini-dance.com. And they're doing this sacred alchemy sexuality workshop for women May 14th, 21st, and June 9th in Vancouver. And it's all about reclaiming your power, opening your body as love, and integrating positive life change in yourself. So I highly recommend you check it out. I think the workshop is getting full. So if you're interested, do check out kundalinidance.com. So thanks, and back to our interview with Dr. Stryker. So before the break, we kind of just touched on the genital surgery conversation. So do you mind returning to that?
Not at all.
Thank you. So what do you think about it?
It depends, and it's complicated.
Okay. yes.
All right. So, you know, I don't think there's any, you know, right way, wrong way, you know, that...
To do transgender.
To do much of anything, you know. It's like there's a lot of room for doing different styles of things. Transgender is the same. I don't think that, you know, anybody should say, oh, you have to have genital surgery, or, you know, like, oh, you really shouldn't have genital surgery. You know, just like, first of all, there's like way too much emphasis on the genital surgery question, I think, but it's only a small part of what some trans people, you know, do.
Body modification and other things.
Right. Uh-huh. But, you know, I think that you can certainly be a man with a vagina or a woman with a penis, if that's what works for you. You know, that I think the biggest part of gender is between your ears and not between your legs.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, I think what people want to do to feel at home in their own bodies is just fine. And that...
piercing, you know, that, tattooing, doesn't, you know, whatever,
right,
it might be,
having,
breast,
you know,
implants.
Starting out with an outie and having it turned into an innie, or vice versa, you know, it's, and that, you know, and that these are not just cosmetic, you know, changes, that it can be really distressing to be embodied in a way that just, you know, doesn't match, you know, what's between your ears.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah, there's no, like, you know, right way, wrong way, you know, should have surgery, shouldn't have surgery. You know, I think it's different. It's different for boys, different for girls, you know, that I know a lot of trans women who can afford it really want the surgery, and a lot of trans guys decide that, you know, the techniques just are not that good yet for mm-hmm. phalloplasty. They might have some other kinds of genital surgeries, you know, decide that, you know, they want to have a really kind of, like, you know, custom genital job.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's sexed women that are born with female genitals that are having labiaplasties now. I mean, a lot of people are doing, like what you're saying, the body modification, which is one of the reasons I love the way that you're organizing it with the Somatechnics idea, body of research as well around what we are doing to ourselves. I mean, it's plastic surgery is huge. I mean, so many people, I've know people that have it getting done. It's such a becoming a regular habit of ours.
And, you know, and the interesting thing there for me is that if you're doing something that surgically changes your body in a way that makes your body more like the ideal or norm of what somebody of your sex is supposed to be, the only thing it takes to get that surgery really is a credit card, you know. But if you're doing something that makes your body, you know, anti-normative or more atypical or somehow breaks the gender mold somehow, well, then you need a psychiatric evaluation, and you need, you know, you need to
have a couple of doctors say it's okay and go through 70 years of like videoing yourself as this other person, and how, you know, then if you look like this, then you can get a penis made, or you can.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's complicated because I think that, you know, there are differences between saying I need to live in a gender other mm-hmm. than the one that I wasn't assigned to when I was born. And, you know, it's like
getting a tummy tuck.
Right. I mean, it's like I really think that my transgender-related body modification needs are healthcare needs, whereas my tattoo was just something that I thought would look cool. It's like, mm-hmm. I didn't feel like I needed to get a prescription for my tattoo.
Right.
And so that I think one of the things that is of interest to me philosophically in transgender studies is, you know, how is it that we distinguish between different kinds of body modification, distinguish between wants and needs, distinguish between something that we think of as being just purely aesthetic versus something that's more needs-based,
mm-hmm.
Without making everything either, you know, kind of like a voluntary aesthetic cosmetic procedure, or, you know, really tightly regulating and controlling all kinds of body modification.
Mm-hmm.
So coming up with a narrative or a story or an analytic or a rubric for, you know, for distinguishing between mm-hmm. those things, I think is, you know, an interesting bit of intellectual work to be done.
Well, it's interesting. I'm somebody who, myself, with a history of studying transgender studies for years, and motivating me to do my master's in the beginning. I didn't become that in the end, but yeah, I could have a very intellectual conversation with you about that rubric idea and sort of the hoops that we go through and why. The only thing I can think about is just the policy side of it, where if the medical system and the taxpayers are paying for this healthcare, which I agree with you. I think if you're distressed, we provide healthcare, whatever it might be, whether it's antidepressants or, you know, genital surgery, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. top surgery, breast surgery, removal, or whatever the trans person might need to feel that they can be productive in their lives and feel good about themselves. And so I agree with, I think it's on a policy thing around the taxpayers paying. In Canada, we go for that. We agree with that. We pay for it. I know that there's still lots of hoops to go through. You know, I'm sure my buddies down at Vancouver Coastal Health could have a whole show just about the hoops that you have to jump through as a trans person attempting to get medical healthcare around these issues. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Do you know what's happening in the States with that? Like, is there any support or do people have to pay like fully?
You know, what I always tell people is that the United States is the most advanced capitalist market economy in the world, which means you can get what you can pay for and nothing else.
Wow.
So, transgender health care is almost never covered through health insurance policies. Yeah. It's extremely rare. There's a few places, the city of San Francisco, actually. If you are a transgender city employee, then the city-funded healthcare is required to provide for that, but it's something that comes out of the San Francisco city budget that they required their insurance carriers to cover, or they would lose their contract with the city.
Okay.
But that's the only place in the United States
I
know of.
Wow.
Some, some big employers, some big corporate employers will agree, on a case-by-case basis. But just, in general, transgender medical needs are considered either elective, experimental, or, not medically necessary.
Oh, it's really disturbing to me. I just think with gender dysphoria, and I know I don't necessarily like to use that word, but when you are born in a body that doesn't feel right, and I know from a fact from the studies, children 2 and 3, as soon as they can speak or react at all or respond to the world in whatever way, they know. They just know. And so I'm sorry, if a child who's completely innocent and going through this that every child goes through about who am I as a gendered body in this world, and they can see the difference between men and women, and they look at themselves and see that this they don't look like the thing that they feel. I mean, and they're just babies. They're 3 years old. You know, if you're trying to tell me that that's like not an actual disconnect, it's just, I mean, I get so riled up. Anyway, we're going to move on. So I'm really happy that Canada is at least being ethical in their support of trans people. Not nearly enough, but just better than the U.S.
Which province you're in.
Does it?
And right now, British Columbia is not one of the places that, it's supposed to be covered, but there isn't funding available for it. So people wind up going to the east or paying out of pocket.
Wow, I don't think I even knew that. It's been a while since I explored the politics and things behind that. Wow, that's disappointing. Maybe I'll have to do some advocacy work again.
There you go.
I was doing it years ago, but it kind of changed, and maybe it sounds like it's changing again. Wow, okay. Well, what about Australia? Is there Europe and Australia? Are they getting any better with support? Do you know? I mean, you seem to be attuned to the Australian world a little bit.
Well, I've just gone there, like I said, usually, a couple of weeks a year. It's a state-funded benefit, just like it is in some of the Canadian provinces.
Okay. Well, that's positive then.
Yeah. So, but I will say the one thing that's different is that when something is state-funded, I've seen this in the UK and Amsterdam. I've seen it, in Canada and Australia, that when it is a state-funded benefit, that there's a lot more regulation of saying that, okay, if we're going to pay for you to do this, then, at the end of the process, you have to be a, pretty, normal guy or a pretty normal woman, that there's a lot more emphasis placed on producing a socially normative body. You can go from column A to column B or vice versa, but they're not paying for any of that, you know, wacky genderqueer stuff. Whereas in the United States...
Like what?
Well, I mean, like in the United States, because it's so market-driven and people really can get only what they can pay for, that, you know, somebody could say, you know, I really don't think of myself as either a man or a woman. I don't like these breasts that I had. I want them removed. I don't want to change the F of my driver's license to an M. Maybe I'll shoot T. Maybe I won't. It's just like, I feel like I'm a person who shouldn't have breasts. That's basically how I feel about myself. And they'll do it. You know, it's like there's, when I first started spending a lot of time outside the U.S., you know, working, you know, more internationally in the trans activism and cultural studies field, people in other parts of the world would look really, you know, people from San Francisco in particular, and say, wow, you guys are so radical. You know, it's like you're really pushing the envelope there. And I never thought of it that way because I knew people who just did what felt right to them, mm-hmm. and they weren't worried about losing some or not being approved for surgery or whatever because, you know, right, they just did what they felt right to them because there wasn't any government telling them, oh, if you're going to do this, then, you know, you have to kind of go all the way. You have to do it in this way. So it was just, it's a much less regulated process in the U.S. than it is in other places.
But then you don't get the support to get, like, the surgery done for the Adam's apple removal and breast surgery and things like
you do. Support for anything.
Really?
No.
Wow. I thought that that was covered.
Nope.
And, like,
nope.
Waxing or, you know, facial
electrolysis
permanent hair removal. Wow.
Nope.
Okay, I don't know what's going on. I'm not
happy. Transgender is a DIY project in the U.S.
Yeah, well, I guess you got to save up for your life just to change into where it is you feel like normal. And, wow. Okay, well, you know what? Let's talk about the conference. We got a few more minutes. You have some really interesting folks presenting at this conference, May 1st
to
3rd.
Yeah, like I said, May 1st through 3rd at Harbor Center, the SFU downtown campus.
How can you register for it?
You can register online. If you go to the SFU Women's Studies Department website, there'll be a link for the conference.
Okay.
We are getting pretty full at this point, but there are a few slots available. Full registration, it's kind of pricey. It's $165 for all 3 days. But if you're a student, we can
give you free or cheaper.
Either free or cheap. Because we did get funding from
Shirk. Okay.
Right. The people who are coming, so we've got something like 120 presenters coming from all over the world. We've got people coming from Taiwan and Australia, Latin America, Europe. You know, it really is an international conference. Our keynote speakers, we have a human rights activist from Argentina, a guy named Mauro Cabral, who I think is just fantastic. A professor from Harvard University, Afsaneh Najmabadi, who is a specialist on transsexuality in the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Wow.
Which is one of the places where there is state-funded sex reassignment surgery. Nikki Sullivan from Macquarie University, one of my colleagues there. And then two pretty well-known Canadian transgender studies scholars, Vivian Namaste from Montreal and Bobby Noble, who used to be right here at UBC, who's at York University now.
Oh, cool. I was wondering what happened to Dr. Noble. Cool. So this is the Transdomatechnics, Theories and Practices of Transgender Embodiment. It sounds like it's just such a very interesting way to organize transdisciplinary, and not meaning transgendered, but multiple disciplines coming
together.
Well,
we can mean both, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. Yeah. It's good. I like the title. It's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I think it's going to be a rockin' event if this, you know, if the topic is kind of up your alley at all.
Yeah.
It's going to be a really, really good show.
I'm hoping to come definitely for Friday, and I'd like to be there as much as possible on Saturday as well. But there's a burlesque element to being of the Vancouver International Burlesque Fest.
Well, I know. That was just completely bad luck that we were doing it the same time as the
festival.
Yeah, because all along I had had this idea, well, you know, you have to have a party when it's over, and we wanted to, you know, to organize some event that would show off local drag and burlesque, you know, drag kings, burlesque performers, because it's like it's all a gender performance mm-hmm. of some kind. And so I believe it's called the Gender Bender Blender Cabaret.
Okay.
It's going to be at Wise Hall, at Nacket Commercial.
Yeah.
Doors at 8, show at 9, public is welcome.
Awesome. Sounds really fun. It sounds like it's one of the many highlights of the Burlesque Festival. So you guys are you riding on the coattails of that kind of
organization? You know, we tried to, but there were some scheduling difficulties and whatnot. So, no, we're not officially related. But, we wish them well. You know?
Well, it sounds really cool. And that's the wrap-up party for your conference.
Right.
Sounds really good. On Saturday, May 3rd.
Right.
Other than the conference, what are you sort of, just to finish the hour, what are you currently working on in transgender studies? You've got lots of other projects.
Well, a couple of things. Let me just, plug a couple of products and projects. You mentioned early on, this lecture that I did when I was in Auckland. What I was talking about there was, that was a few years ago, and I was showing a rough cut of what was then a work in progress, this film that's been on U.S. public television on the early history of transgender political activism. The film was called Screaming Queens, The Riot at Compton's Cafeteria.
Cool.
And, many people have heard about the Stonewall Riot in New York in 1969, which, people generally think of as the beginnings of,
the GLBT
mm-hmm. movement. But, putting on my, historian hat, digging through the archive, I came across some descriptions of an earlier riot in San Francisco where transgender street prostitutes fought back against the police in August of 1966.
Before the Stonewall.
Before Stonewall. So a graduate school buddy of mine, this guy named Victor Silverman, he and I learned to be filmmakers together.
Great.
And we made a film about it. Wow. And it's available from Frameline Distribution. That's frameline.org.
I'll put that on my website so that my listeners can grab that.
Excellent. Thank you.
Yeah.
Other kind of current projects, I did an anthology year before last, 2006, called The Transgender Studies Reader. It was published by Routledge. I'm very proud that that won a Lambda Literary Award.
Wow,
So anyway, that's, very academic. It's a phone book. If you don't like what's in it, just use it to prop your door open or something. It's really thick.
Has this become a text for students?
Yeah, it's adopted for classroom use.
Great.
All over the place.
Awesome.
I've got a new book that actually just came out last week from Seal Press, which is a feminist publisher. They have a new series on it's kind of like primer introductory texts on, current issues in feminist politics and history. And I did a book called I didn't pick the title. They called it Transgender History, but it's a history of the transgender political movement in the United States.
Interesting.
That's just out.
Fabulous.
Available from Seal Press, like I said.
Congratulations.
And we're running out of time here, I see, but I am working on a new film project right now.
Cool.
It will be, there's a long pipeline, from conceiving it to like actually putting it out there in the world. But in the next few years, I will get another film out. It's called Christine in the Cutting Room.
Wow, that's a great film, really.
Right. Well, what's interesting about it to me, it's about an early transsexual celebrity, Christine Jorgensen, who kind of became, she had her 15 minutes of fame back in the 1950s.
I remember reading about her.
Right. As kind of like, it was through her celebrity that a lot of people first became aware that changing sex was a medical possibility. What most people don't know about Jorgensen, they think of her just as, a celebrity, if they think of her at all. She was famous for being transsexual. But before her transition, She worked as a photographer and a filmmaker, and she actually worked at RKO Studios in New York in the editorial department. She worked in the cutting room, cutting film, and that I really think there's a relationship that was going on in her mind about the relationship between body modification practices and filmmaking. You know, that you if you think about it as, oh, wait, you know, you cut the medium in a certain way, you splice it together, and you use the medium to project, you know, you project through the medium to create an image and tell
a story.
Right. And so that thinking about, you know, kind of focusing on Christine in the cutting room, the film cutting room, I think is a really good way of re-narrating the sort of the medical pathology story of transsexuals. You know, it wasn't just doctors operating on her. It was more like she was the director and was hiring, you know, skilled craft services, you know, to, you know, to realize her vision. So I'm making a film about Jorgensen's own film work and you know, kind of re-narrating the history of transsexuality in the 50s. But anyway, Transsoma Technics, May 1 through 3, Harbor Center. Check out the information on the SFU Women's Studies website and get one of those last few seats available in the Fletcher Challenge Auditorium.
It's going to be fabulous. And
I think so.
Really appreciate your time, Dr. Schreiger. It's such an such a busy time for you right now. Currently holding the Ruth Wynn Woodward Endowed Chair in Women's Studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. Dr. Susan Schreiger, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. It's
really
fun.
Really appreciate it. All right. And I guess you're in your juice box is wrapping up. Hans Claus is, what do you call yourself now, darling?
Hans von
Claus. Hans von Claus. Is it still the misery hour?
Of course it is.
Okay.
He's even more miserable. I sound more Nazi now.
Okay, he's more miserable than ever. And please stay tuned for that show. In the meantime, if you have recommendations for a show topic, you'd like to hear, or questions about anything to do with sexuality or relationships, please feel free to email me, Julia@juiceboxradio.com.
Julia.
Tune into Juicebox Radio every Wednesday night at 10 o'clock. Thanks for listening. You just experienced Juicebox Radio, a show dedicated to developing your relational and individual sexual health, expressing diversity, celebrating queerness, and encouraging pleasure at all stages. Be sure to tune into Juicebox every Wednesday night at 10. In the meantime, you can check out juiceboxradio.com. Thanks for listening.
If any member of the family should die whilst in the shelter from contamination, put them outside. But remember to tag them first for identification purposes. last voice that you will ever hear. Do not be alarmed. If any member of the family should die whilst in the shelter from contamination,